You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Orthodox Nationalist. As usual, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it's the 15th of February, 2023. For those of you who have contacted me and I haven't gotten back to you, I'm sorry about that. It's something that I tend to be very slow on. It's nothing about you personally. I could guarantee it. I've published two new articles on Patreon, and I have this, I think I mentioned it before, this booklet coming up on the so-called Bodo League massacre in South Korea during the Korean War and My Lai in Vietnam. These governments, anti-communist military governments in Asia and Latin America, you know, I have a book on the Latin American version, very rarely are they treated as anything other than just purely negative defenders of landlordism or some slogan like that. And there's almost no countervailing ideas. And of course, as always, like with everything, the academic wisdom, the popular wisdom is incorrect. And this is going to be a continuing project. Now, today, I want to go back to one of my favorite topics going back to grad school, where I got into this very deeply. And I want to be using a few sources here. E. Michael Jones's Logos Rising, chapter 4, is one of the best chapters in this. If you haven't gotten it yet, it works almost as a companion piece to my book on nominalism. And if you haven't gotten that, you know, get on it already. That is selling very well, and I appreciate it. But chapter 4 is called The Beginnings of Philosophy. Now, I'm not going to go over necessarily the chapter in detail. You can read. But there are many sources dealing with this period, ancient Greece, from roughly 800 BC to 300. That 450, 500-year period is the most significant as far as intellectual development. And people like Christopher Dawson, Jones, Eric Voegelin, Leo Strauss sometimes. There's so many who have dealt with this rationally. Now, of course, in academia, you're not going to get serious coverage of this essential area. And tracing out the development of Logos and Nous, two sides of the same coin, we've dealt with these concepts 100 times before, is very similar to the development of the Platonic forms on the one hand and natural law on the other. This is the germination. And Eric Voegelin's Order in History, Volume 2, is extremely useful in this regard. And you know, he's not an undergraduate writer. He's definitely a grad school writer. He has his own vocabulary. And in actually Hegel's History of Philosophy, he deals with this era in great detail, or as much detail as you could have had in the beginning of the 19th century. So the question remains, what, first of all, can we, you know, we distinguish Nous and Logos, which Jones, by the way, does extremely well. Voegelin does it very well, too, although in much greater detail. What was it about Ionia and this part of Greece, including, you know, South Italy was Greek many years ago, that the concept of both nous and logos developed. Logos, of course, is defined as the structure of creation, the law-boundness of it, that it is regular. And it had to have been created that way, since regularity doesn't just develop, especially given the immense complexity of that today, from DNA all the way down to cosmology. Nous is both a faculty, higher than logic, reason with a capital R, and it's able to perceive the forms, it's able to perceive this exterior order, because it has the same creator, and it's really made up of the same complete lack of material. Logic just connects means to ends. Of course, in 2023, logic is going to be considered the same as reason, and that's a huge error. Animals use logic all the time. It doesn't mean that they're capable of reason. Nous is that faculty that can conceive and understand the interrelations of the cosmos on the one hand, and as a microcosm, the human soul and the polis on the other. It's not logic as a practical matter. It takes reason to the highest level and something that's specifically human. The problem is, of course, that's an aristocratic discipline. Now, during this time, earlier than what we're talking about here, places like Troy controlled access to the Black Sea, very close to, and of course that links the Mediterranean to Central Asia. This is their access to the Great Silk Road, and control over the Black Sea, on the other hand, allows access to Central Europe, the Danube River, and as Jones and Vogelin mention, the tin mines of Bohemia, and even in Britain, which combined, once you create this bronze alloy, which, changed how militaries and how technology functioned at the time. Now, that's just an introduction to this ebb and flow of philosophical speculation at the time. In addition to that, there was a clear division, as I think everyone knows, between Persia and the Hellenes. The one being, and there's, Vogelin says that the Iliad is this statement of the difference between, and so does Herodotus, he says the same thing, between these two very different civilizations. When we use the phrase Oriental despotism, it refers to the fact that there really is no, the sources of information aren't necessarily from Nous. It may be symbolized from it, but it's based on a cosmology rather than an epistemology. And excavating these areas many, many years ago gave us a whole new look as to where all of this stuff comes from, because the history of philosophy isn't just one idea following on another. That's how it's usually taught. But there's historical antecedents and events that lead to one idea or another. And, of course, ideas are creative of events. It's not a simple matter. Usually historians do one part, philosophers do the other part, and it's not too often, although that's changed recently, that those two fields come together. Eric Vogelin, and I've always recommended his stuff on Gnosticism, which we can't get into today, as his statement of a lot of this material, and that the understanding of nous, logos, the forms, is, and the birth of these things in the mind, deals with order. Not order as in law and order, although that can be a dim reflection of it, but the very source of this cosmic regularity. Cosmic laws, for example, including the most basic, is a law of contradiction. But Eric Voegelin, he speaks of writers like, you know, Homer, who was roughly a contemporary. The question is not just where order comes from, but where disorder comes from. And he says that the social order, we're talking about the time, is always threatened with disintegration. You can see this with Rome as well, because at any given moment, there's the danger of conduct deriving from passion rather than reason. Again, reason both with a small r and a capital R. And Jones, too, says the Iliad therefore becomes a study in the social disorder which flows from the moral pathology of its heroes. Now, the key issue is that concept of nous and the formal order of things hadn't yet developed. These are the very foundations of it. You see things like the various heroes, not in Asian writing, but in Greek writing. Even at this early stage, you see the hero engaging in acts of wantonness, license, passion, and that's when things fall apart. And Eric Voegelin and Jones, a whole bunch of other people, have noted, Christopher Dawson, that the Iliad was composed roughly 700 BC. And he notes that the hoplite phalanx and the end of the chariot as this dominant factor in war occurred. In other words, order was slowly being discovered. It wasn't just, you know, fighters on a field of battle. It was organized. But any time you're seeking out order, you seek out the principles of order. On the other hand, Persia, you know, with Homer and Hesiod, you have, as Voegelin says, the gods operating out in the open and discussing things, attempting to be as rational as possible. In Persia, you don't see that so much. Now, Voegelin also mentions a term, a Greek term that we haven't dealt with yet. Sophrosyne. It's a self-restraint, not the martial of virtues, of bravery or excellence in warfare, but a moderation in behavior. The virtue in order to keep excess from entering into your mentality. Reason slowly, in the way that the gods on Olympus were depicted. Now, of course, they're not meant to be real people. And this still was at a very primitive state, though. On the other hand, you know, the way that the Persians operated, they operated mostly through oracles or things like dreams. It's not to say that they were, you know, they didn't have a rational system in various ways, but they hadn't progressed as far in understanding order as the Greeks had done. And fate is something that ties the actions of the Greek heroes together. But note that the gods have no control over that. This isn't the Oriental despot, the ruler of all things, but something that could be understood rationally. Things like fate stand in for something. It's the Oriental despotism, the notion of a civil ruler. That is, in fact, considered some version of divinity. And there has to be a manipulation there. And that was the Athenian attack on the Persians. But fate is something that is nameless. Fate is just a stand-in term. And it's far more powerful than any set of gods. Even in Hesiod, the working out of fate is far more powerful than not only the decisions of the gods, but also the decisions of the heroes involved in all of these stories. Now, Hesiod's a different. He's mostly dealing with gods. The Iliad deals with both men and gods. But the point of all of this, whether we're dealing with Hesiod or Homer, is we're talking about types of cosmic and ethical force, relations, the dialectics among them. It's not just myth as such, but myth that has this fate going through it. A fate that's more powerful than the errors, including the errors of the gods. There is an attempt to create a cosmic idea of law for the very first time. And that's what makes this, generally speaking, the precursor to what we'll talk about in a second as Greek speculation. Aristotle, as Jones says, we've come across this before. Hesiod was the first man to look for universal causes. He's talking about the primordial deities, forms themselves, although only in the most poetic form. And not just that, but that there can be a first cause, the ultimate cause of order, that holds them all together. This is the first time people notice laws, not just in nature, but in human behavior, patterns that can never seem to be overthrown. And when that's recognized, whether in literary or speculative form, the natural human drive, and this is nous, seeks to find out what anchors it. These things don't just happen. Chaos in the traditional sense, not in the sense that I've dealt with before, can't create order because there's nothing from which order can be generated. Now, chaos in the more philosophical sense is an order that's extremely complex, and because of that, very hard to predict. So, the drive in these stories, the interrelations amongst the gods, fate as the thread that runs through all of their actions, and someone had to have, you know, created this. Fate doesn't just happen, but there's really no speculation then as to where it comes from. You start a revolution. I mean, you had the economic foundation, you had the political foundation, the development of the polis and all the rest of it. And polis was very aristocratic, dealing with close to nous, to politics as humanly possible. From all of this, you get what we call the pre-Socratics. The pre-Socratics being this group of often very misunderstood philosophers, mostly materialists to a great extent, that took the implications of Hesiod and Homer and rationalized them. In other words, they use symbols, of course, but they don't need stories for this. Stories imply something. It implies a tremendous philosophical apparatus or a scaffolding that they want to make rational, something that you can use discursive reason. And this, again, is something very specifically human. That the Homeric epics, this was, as Jones says, it's a moral instrument, almost a cultural tool that awakened the consciousness of the Greek nation and the Greek mind. That there's a continuity and that there is an ethnic and national element to this, despite the fact that this was, in essence, a civil war. Fall of Troy to the appearance of the Homeric epics, and from that to the pre-Socratics. And coming from this, and this seeking for order, is the polis, the Greek-speaking aristocracy. In order for them to rule something, they had to themselves be ruled. The most difficult entity to rule is the soul. The old warrior ethic has this Nietzschean overflowing passion that's extremely hard to control, and in fact can't be controlled. It's what takes a nation and makes an empire out of it. Empire in the sense that it isn't an ethnic or moral connection among people. It's simply a system imposed by force. All modern ideologies, having deviated from logos and nomos, have imposed themselves by force. All revolutions create civil war, and it creates a reaction of sorts, like a Napoleon or a Stalin, that then seeks to export the revolution to anyone who is vulnerable enough to accept it. One way to look at it is that the old warlord system, the war band, this violence, this almost Hobbesian collection of purely passionate and out of control people, then gets sublimated into politics. And this is the origin of the idea that politics really is warfare, just made in connection with nomos and logos rather than pure self-interest. The concept of the aristocrat was developing in this era, and the nature of aristocracy here was this group of people, and usually a small minority, that can exercise control over their very powerful passion. Revenge is a big one, sexuality, irrational behaviors that are fully understandable but are not consistent with any kind of civil society. If you command yourself, you then build up this capacity to build a rational order. The concept of the polis is a rational social order, one that has to be maintained through reason all the time. This isn't the divine kingship of the Persians, but it also isn't purely subjective. Reason is purely subjective and basically useless unless you hold to some conception of realism, that there are laws that have been created by someone more powerful than them, because laws don't come from nothing, and we don't create them, we simply discover them. So the concept of the universal king has been rationalized. The Trinity is one of the great examples of this. The order that exists in the cosmos is reflected in the polis, and that is reflected in the human soul. Now, people will call this and have, you know, so-called Greek democracy, and it just isn't true. The polis comes into existence to avoid the two extremes of the Oriental despot on the one hand and the subjective, purely self-interested logic of factions, economic or otherwise. You read in books like Revolt of the Masses is that if you were to have this kind of aristocratic democracy, that, you know, this is a rule of not just people, but the best of people, or the most rational of people, I should say, the people who understand this kind of thing, there's a tremendous amount of work involved. Everything from budgeting to foreign policy requires, if you're going to truly be self-ruling, not a bureaucracy that could take care of these things, in other words, outsourcing your policy, there's a huge amount of debate and discussion, far beyond the capacity of the typical politician, since in liberal democracy, the only thing that's rewarded is deception, the complete rejection of philosophy in people like Machiavelli and Thomas Hobbes. Intellectual history demands that we bring at least an outline of the economic foundations of this, and it's true, you have to have a certain length of peaceful development, and you have to have a certain level of prosperity. This exists for the history of philosophy just like it exists, but for example, in Aristotle, that a certain minimum of material goods have to exist before we could even think of what the good life might be. So you have several things coming together. This older religious feeling, a so-called sacred city, and to a great extent, this really comes down to the development of ethnicity, the Hellenic city. The strict discipline, the civil, the solidarity, the racial connection, the kinship, which makes every city and every region sort of a large family, especially when you're speaking the same language. This is not a passive obedience. The connection of ethnicity to the development of a prosperous world, and then not just to speculation about the cosmos and the human soul, but actually manifesting it in behavior, and ultimately for politics, the polis itself. And the early polis in parts of Greece, like Ionia, were very competitive. E. Michael Jones talks about this in the beginning of philosophy, that there was a huge production of, you know, literary and scientific works because people were, in the best sense, competing with one another as to who can come up with, and you even see this in Plato's Republic, see who come up with the best, most rational, and most parsimonious theory of things. Now, of course, that has to be an aristocratic concern. We're talking mostly Asia Minor, and we're talking the time of Solon, who died in 558 BC. Solon is worth talking about because we kind of associate his name with the polis, but he was the first to put natural law, that is to say, criteria for a social order based on universal truth. Now, of course, that has to be very general. Specific truth, or logic, for example, that's where ethnicity matters, the specific historical and economic development of a people. But, of course, we're not cultural relativists. There has to be a natural law to hold all this together, or you have no place to stand, intellectually or politically, to fight any behavior you don't happen to like. So what people like Thales and Anaximander and the pre-Socratics were doing in coming up with the foundations of all order in general, people like Solon manifest in the polis, which is a, you know, relatively small city-state circumstance. It's the same drive to universal foundations. The universe, or, you know, the cosmic order, the polis, or this mesocosm, and the soul is a microcosm. They all have one thing in common, is that they are all ruled by not fate. Fate ends up becoming rationalized into natural law. I mean, fate is just a very crude version of this. Logos should be applied to the social order. In fact, it should be applied everywhere. It's not an accident that in the Enlightenment, especially in its more radical varieties leading to the French Revolution and the British Revolution shortly before that, while they were so concerned with scientific exactitude and mathematical precision, they had nothing to say when it came to moral action. And it does make sense with the development of capitalism and then much later the Industrial Revolution, where the last thing they wanted to hear was logos or this natural law that they had to abide by. Logic ruled over reason in nous. Without Solon, you could not have gotten Plato or Aristotle. Solon was the first one, was a great founder of this polis system. Order is meant to not just produce a manifestation of cosmic order, universal truth, natural law, but also in the creation of human happiness. It's not an accident, too, that Plato made the claim that you can't be happy, no matter what you may think at the moment, doing evil deeds, because it's something that's inhuman. We're not talking about reason or nous applied to anything. Logic can be applied to anything. The most evil actions have a logical foundation. It could be very crude, no different than animals. Nous is always geared towards being and therefore goodness, evil being the misuse of things that are. Now, 6th century BC, people like Vogelin and Dawson, a whole bunch of others, take that as a very important era. Let me quote Jones here, and he's actually himself quoting Dawson. Throughout the ancient world, from the Mediterranean to India and China, men came to realize the existence of a universal cosmic law to which both humanity and the powers of nature are subject. This was the foundation of the great religious civilizations, whether theistic or non-theistic, which have controlled the world for some 2,000 years. It's from this that the polis, or the Greek city-state, the aristocratic city-state, developed. And it becomes clear pretty soon that there's a big difference between aristocracy and oligarchy. Now, I don't want to make too fine a distinction, or I should say too broad of a distinction between the Oriental and the Athenian idea. This is excessively simple. But as far as the Greek mind at the time, there was this huge division between the two. And until this Ionian counter-revolution, to put an end to irrationality and warfare and the domination of just those who happen to be the strongest, we're talking about a period of time now where the classical world was created and brought into being. The warrior tribe on the one hand and the nous on the other. It's not these dark forces of magic, but reason, both in the macrocosm and the microcosm, that our actions must conform to. It was a complete transformation in this era. You know, in Thales, same thing, from like 620 to 520, 530, was one of the first to try to create a scientific universal theory of reality, of causality. And some of you may know, he's a great first cosmologist and physicist who sought to do these things purely on a rational foundation, who held that it was water. You know, the four elements, which are not literally those elements. I can't tell you how many professors still actually think that he believes that water, literally water, was the foundation and root of everything. There is a materialist element to this, but that's not, you know, actual functional water. And it's this drive to create this universal theory, this universal foundation, where things like geometry and political virtue came into existence. The question was now, if they're universal truth manifest in natural law, then what is changing? Obviously, this you know, although some pre-Socratics did say that change is a myth, there has to be something that we see something grow, develop, germinate, and reach its terminus. There's a lot of change. You know, the baby is not the adult. The seed is not the flower. And yet, it has to be the same thing. The flower has to exist in potentia in the seed. So something, in a sense, can be and not be at the same time. There was something permanent. No matter how bad or how quickly change develops, the change goes from something into something else. That means there has to be something that persists. A third concept that can handle various forms and goes through a process of change which is rational. In other words, it's not random. It's not just a conflict. It's not just you know, the Darwinian struggle for survival. It's far more significant than that. The cosmology of Thales and Anaximenes, what is this ground of all things? Now, of course, at the time, you only had the four elements, but that actually gets refined over time. And the question of what they pick, it could be air, it could be water, it could be fire, and Heraclitus, that's not so much the issue. What matters is that for the first time, they're seeking out the very outlines of what logos might be. So the fundamental idea is that the cosmos, to be a cosmos, has to be governed by law. There is no such thing as spontaneity or arbitrary action. And I mentioned the hoplite phalanx, the beginning of the polis, and this search for order, logos, all occurred roughly around the same time. They're looking for logos in the sense that what can be perceived, what can be understood as a foundation for not just all permanence, but all change. Now, Anaximenes, who died in 528 BC, did the same thing that Thales did. the symbol of water in his case. It was the element of air. And this connection between the cosmic order on the one hand and our personal order on the other. Air, similar to fire, these are the two most ethereal elements. Air was always connected with the spiritual world, which is why birds were always connected with the spiritual world. So saying that the origin is air, he doesn't actually mean the wind that blows. Although it's increasingly rare to find someone who understands that. It's just a way to express the fact that there is a spiritual element, and that's very vaguely defined at the time, which holds the cosmic order together. By the time Aristotle comes around, any materialism is largely gone. But, you know, terms like spiritus in Latin, even in Greek, it's breath. You know, during the baptismal ceremony in the ancient world, you breathe on the person. The priest has to breathe on the person. This is the connection between air on the one hand and spirit on the other. Anaximander is yet another one, dying 546 BC, made a distinction that was more or less, certainly far less material than the previous. But the difference between Hyperon and Paros, or the unlimited and the limited, as two concepts that can explain both change and permanence. If the origin of everything is the absolute, something that's boundless, individual things and the change among things can exist among those limitations, boundaries from one object to another. But this is the first time now that you have something more or less spiritual, not an element, although this would be a variation of air. His key element, and Vogelin and Dawson says this in various ways. Now you don't have something that can be interpreted as a physical thing, as a foundation of everything. However you describe water in the ancient world, it had a materialist foundation, even though it was symbolic. Anaximander was the first one to divest the foundation of all qualities, number, color, anything like that, things that we can perceive, and reduce it to a rational principle. Things that we see in our specific finite experience are removed, and it's an infinity, although he didn't know what it was, that didn't have qualities that we can perceive as a foundation of everything. That's in itself revolutionary. A lot of the pre-Socratics, we don't have, we have mostly fragments. We don't have a lot by them. But now you have the first time where something that is infinite, that is to say boundless or absolute, is the foundation of everything. And as far as we know, he didn't go much further than that. And Aristotle would later say that this concept of the Hyperon is the first step towards understanding the unknown God, or the rationalized version of fate, necessity, or blatant cause and effect as being the only realities, is now done away with. In a way, Aristotle's concept of the unmoved mover, or God, lifeless and purely, you know, logical deity, not someone you could have any kind of relationship with, that which moves but is not himself moved, in other words, the origin of all things, is which derives from Anaximander. And the last is Heraclitus, and he, you know, his element is fire. You see the word fire showing up even in the Old Testament. And of course, he doesn't mean actual fire in a physical sense. He's talking about the constant tension amongst opposites. He uses the metaphor of the bow before you let it go. There's a tension, possibly a creative tension, where opposite forces are fighting one another, reason and passion, for example. And this is also a semi-spiritual conception of the foundation of all things. But you also had the concept of fire being connected with gold and love. Now, I've said this before, where love has no, you know, the modern saccharine conception of love is a modern perversion. And even as the polis began to decay, you start seeing words like sophrosyne being completely remade and redefined. Love is something, as I've said in the past, the relationship between the organs and the body. By themselves, they're nothing. Therefore, they have a vested interest in making sure that the entire organism functions, not just themselves. Now, Heraclitus says, and many people realize this, that flux is part of the nature of fire too. Everything flows, so to speak. Now, Jones, Voegelin, say that this is an extremely simplistic idea. Heraclitus is seen as the philosopher of chaos. You can't step into the same river twice. Well, but it's still a river. What's important here is that part of the nature of fire is strife and warfare, broadly speak, between reason and the passions, between logic and impulse. This strife is part of the development of humanity, whether it be warfare as such or the warfare internally, the warfare between good and evil. This is a good thing in the sense that it brings us to understanding. This is another way of saying that this constant battle of opposing forces is one way that human beings can understand this cosmic order. And of course that generates heat, friction, as Karl Marx would say later on, and therefore fire makes sense as a symbol here. But of course, Heraclitus also said that this itself has a foundation. He believed, for example, all things are one. The concept of fire, the symbol of cosmic order, the juxtaposition of logos on the one side and nous on the other. And of course, things like the philosophy of Zoroaster creates this constant tension between two entities. And the problem there is that the evil side, the negative side, has a being in itself, which of course is absolutely unacceptable. Non-being isn't being. Fire became an essential element, an essential symbol for cosmic order from there on in. There's a, in the old Russian prayers after communion, there's a phrase that referring to God saying, "You are fire by nature." And that's in the old rite as well as the new rite. I've even seen it in the Ukrainian rite. And people ask what that is. And it comes down to the fact that this is a battle that leads to the reconciliation of opposites. And that's the definition of peace. Fire by nature is Christ as a warrior. But even more than that is far greater than just the battle of opposites. In fact, it is a foundation. It is a battlefield on which all of that takes place. The upshot to all of this, as far as fire is concerned, that we understand cosmic order as an equilibrium, as opposing forces at a state of very fragile peace one with another, sort of like the balance of power in old Europe. Still, though, you have a materialist foundation. And the same thing goes from Parmenides. Again, these are all roughly at the same time. He died in 540. And, of course, he's famous for one very important thing, is that change does not exist. And the issue is, and you've come across all of the arguments that, you know, because space is infinitely divisible, you can't actually go anywhere. And, you know, you can't run 20 feet because the measure is infinite. You can divide space infinitely, and therefore you can never traverse it. And this, you know, this was played around with in this era, that change is an illusion because change can't happen. Order is the only thing. But he did understand one thing, and that reason can only function in a non-material world. If, you know, we talk about philosophy as a science, the mentality, the science of being, it was Parmenides that got it started. Ultimately, Parmenides is a universalist and a materialist. See, these things hadn't fully developed yet. You have this back and forth of a few concepts that, you know, ended up destroying each other, collapsing in on themselves. Remember, it's not so much the result or the conclusion. It's the method. Pythagoras, as you well know, numbers. Numbers are essentially a primitive version of forms. And then the atomists and people like Democritus. It's not an accident. Again, that materialism in particular, this is a regression, although it came into existence again with Newton and the atomic theory of reality, where, of course, it's this energy that creates things. And this energy, of course, in the Newtonian universe doesn't have any real purpose, doesn't have any real function. It's simply random interaction that can be understood very crudely. Now, a lot of that model is gone. That model only existed in a vacuum. In other words, it existed at a time, a place that doesn't exist. The concept of atoms in the void that you see with, you know, some of the atheist existentialists, you know, Sartre and people like that, actually give causal primacy to a void. And gravity attempted to take the place of gravity, the hidden hand in the Enlightenment. This was a re-mythologization of fate. It was now back to being a crude understanding, mythical really. That somehow non-being is productive of something. Non-being, empty space, actually could exist. You have people like Empedocles and many of these, you know, very early philosophers of the Greek world, that the foundations, the four elements of the world in their symbolic form exist in a very, very tense and delicate equilibrium. Anaxagoras was one of the first theoreticians of nous. And that word comes up many times. I'm going to read from Frederick Copleston. When I was in college and in early grad school, I went through his multi-volume work on the history of philosophy. And in his book on the pre-Socratics, from Thales on, you see the first real definition of a concept of nous from Anaxagoras. And it goes like this, I'm quoting directly now. Nous has power over all things that have life, both greater and smaller. And nous had power over the whole revolution, so that it began to revolve at the start. Now by revolution, he's talking about the motions of the planets, circular motion, etc. And nous set in order all things that were to be and all things that were and are now, and that will be in this revolution, which now revolve the stars and the sun and the moon and the air and the aether, which are separated off. The revolution itself caused this separating off, and dense is separated off from the rare, warm from the cold, bright from the dark, and the dry from the moist. and there are many portions in many things, but nothing is altogether separated off from anything else except nous. Now, this is in Copleson's book. It's actually a quote from Anaxagoras himself. But this is, again, another mini breakthrough. Nous is autonomous. It is also infinite, that is, unbounded, and exists only by itself. This is why Aristotle, as Jones mentions, said that Anaxagoras stood out like a sober man from the random talkers and babblers that had preceded him. The nature, the primitive nature of these speculations is still productive of course, the explosion of Plato and Aristotle a few centuries before Christ. But this movement, all of these various pre-Socratic theories, as strange as they often sound, as incomplete as they are, the fact that we only have fragments leads to one conclusion. You take them all together, you see that there are two entities that emerge. Logos, as the structure of the cosmos, the foundation of the law that governs everything, that holds everything together, and nous, or the apprehension, or the ability to apprehend being with a capital B, which is another way of saying Plato's forms, natural law, the cosmic laws, the structure of being itself. This is something that is discovered, as I mentioned before, not constructed. Nous is part of the same stuff, so to speak, as the cosmic order, therefore has a certain affinity to it. Given the fact that man is both body and soul, there is this constant warfare between the so-called bodily passions, which, because of their impulsiveness and because of their power, can easily overthrow rational decision-making. Even at the time we realize that acting on it is not in our interests, we do it anyway. This is the ontological origin of sin, or actually the anti-ontological origin. And it comes down to making this one claim. And I don't really care about these guys, except in the sense that they all worried about a common substratum that holds all things together. And this is why I mentioned in the beginning the concept of the world religions coming out of this era, generally speaking. Monotheism is the only thing that makes any sense when you understand things this way, because ultimately all of the specific truths have to have a common origin. We use the word truth to cover a whole lot of things, not just because it's random, not just because it's easy, because it all actually manifests one real entity. E. Michael Jones says, roughly in this same era, he says, the triumph of Newtonian physics and the Enlightenment had a stultifying effect on philosophy because it returned to the atomism of Empedocles and Democritus, who, instead of applying the mind to logos in order to grasp being in all of its complexity, it reduced the many to the true reality of atomic being, which lay just beneath the surface of appearances. That is the opposite of what we're talking about here. People like Parmenides, as I've mentioned already, and several others, brought out the idea of this faculty, this nous, which is made of the same, I don't know what to call it, the same stuff, I can't say material, as the very order of the universe. But Plato also, much later, noted that these laws have to exist somewhere. Despite them not having any space, you know, they're immaterial things, so they're beyond time and space, you bring them together, and logos then has to be in the mind of God. In fact, it has to be God, because this is the being of being, the foundation of all foundations. Anaxagoras, Parmenides, the development of nous as not reason, not logic, put something above both of them. This is the pre-Socratic, and this is where Plato and Aristotle come from. There's one problem, though. The concept of God, logos being mind of God, is slowly coming into existence. You still have, though, the older mythical conceptions of Greek religion, which, of course, is both an economic and a civil matter. I use the word religion only in the most vague sense. If you go through my Paganism is Not a Religion, it's been republished in a bunch of places. These aren't gods in the sense we use the word God. These are often irrational people. They're clearly modeled on people, and it doesn't matter that the stories change all the time. There's no sacred scripture here. But when you have a regime that's dedicated to this mythical conception of the gods, and then you come and confront them with this Platonic logos, there's going to be a problem. And that problem led to the murder of Socrates. And around the era of both, you know, especially Plato, and of course his student Aristotle later, this whole synthesis was coming apart. Another big problem that came out of the pre-Socratic movement is the fact that the ultimate foundation under which all of these theories can be brought under wasn't able to come into being. Really until Plato. And there is this gap here, and that gap was filled by the Sophists. The Sophists are the most modern of the ancient classes. They're a combination of both lawyers, media controllers, politicians, bureaucrats, professors, PR, for all in one class of people. The pre-Socratic, this whole cosmology eventually fell apart, because there was no reason to accept Heraclius over Anaximander, over Parmenides, over Democritus. That was the problem. This is where Plato comes from. In the meantime, in that gap, the Sophists took over as a purely relativist, very corrupt institution that, of course, Plato spent his entire life fighting. They rejected all concepts of natural law or universal truths. They worked for money. They were very exploitative. They lent at interest. Any kind of stable truth, moral or otherwise, they rejected. And if, to the extent they actually believed that, they could take money to make any case. Since all arguments were the same, all conclusions are the same, and this, again, it comes from the collapse of this Ionian Greek, the pre-Socratic movement, the search for foundations was abandoned. The only thing left, of course, is power. Power and self-interest. It's the opposite of logos and nous. Power and self-interest. Nous and logos were connected with authority. That's not the same thing as power. And it's no accident, people like Thrasymachus, who was one of the great Sophists of the era, it's based on, you know, the 411 BC conversation with Socrates, where the Sophist made the claim that power, the will of the stronger, is the only reality. And that was used as a foil to build what, we call today the Republic. Connected with that, too, is the rise of empire. E. Michael Jones says this page 171. He says, after the Greeks defeated the Persians, they embarked upon the path of empire, which corrupted their morals and eventually destroyed them from within. People like Christopher Dawson say this: it's this era that created the catastrophic enfeeblement of Hellenism in the 4th century BC to something analogous to disease in individual organism. Athens has gone from, as many have said in the past, a aristocratic polis, republic, so to speak, to a substantial and very wealthy empire. Again, empire in the reductionist sense of being able to impose its agenda, its will, solely by force. And that is what leads to Plato's story of the cave. I've hinted at it. I've described it in very general terms many times in the past. But in the age of both empire, oligarchy, and the rise of the sophists, again, no accident here. They're all connected, which obviously has relevance to our era. The sophists ruled the world of the cave, the world of darkness, the world of shadows, created by an elite that you're never allowed to see or talk about, casting shadows in the wall and really satisfying. You know, people loved these shadows, loved the falsehood. They didn't know it was false. They didn't care. But every once in a while, someone escapes and is able to see the sunlight for the first time, and they're blinded. It's frightening. It's disorienting. This is the world of forms. This is the world of cosmos. Nomos. Of course, if they return to the cave, they're blinded by something else. The total ignorance of this population. The same population that ends up killing Socrates. The same population that crucifies Christ and everybody like that afterwards. Stephen, all the rest of them. But Plato notes that there is very advanced science on these shadows cast on the wall. You know, these aren't stupid people. They're ignorant people, but they're not stupid people. And people love this falsehood. Falsehood is far more interesting to them than truth. And it's true that, you know, Plato has a particularly harsh conception of human life in this corrupt era. Because to the extent a society is unjust, the truth of justice, the form of justice, gets further and further away. This is the origin of things like Plato's theory of forms, the development of the concept of nous and logos to a fairly high level of sophistication by the time Aristotle dies. It's extremely difficult to describe because our language doesn't deal with these eternal things. Greek, especially here, as this, you know, the trading relationships of this part of the world, in Asia Minor, connecting all the world really essentially came together there, physically, trade routes. Their language became very rich. Far more words and inflections than other languages at the time. Meaning that they can start slowly building vocabulary to deal with this kind of thing. And this built slowly but surely. But in terms of archetypes, God, logos, our language can't reflect it very well. These are all approximations. We can't really describe God. That's impossible. So we use something beneath metaphors. We have no other language but human language. And assigning too much weight to it is a mistake, and Plato was well aware of this. That's why things like the four elements, the cave, the myth of Er, places like the, you know, these stories have come into existence, because only through that kind of narrative, and Plato even says things like music and various kinds of very controlled artistic enterprises, is just as important. Plato doesn't rely much on discursive reason in his writing, like Aristotle will. But it is in the form of a dialogue, which is exactly what we talked about with the sublimation of the warrior passionate spirit in competition of a rational sort, which we would call the origin of the polis in this case. I think the best place to bring this all together is Plato himself. Now, of course, I've dealt with him separately 100 times. But Plato finally brings together all the pre-Socratics, arranges them, and makes sense out of them. I've already mentioned the term love, and it's used again. Harmonious love is what Plato expressed. He blends the opposites, hot, cold, or wet and dry, whatever, course of the seasons. This tuned lyre, you know, lyre strings, guitar strings, are very taut and can be very dangerous. But this harmony is what brings to everything, not just human beings, health and plenty, and can do them no harm. Wanton love is a different story. It's the application of this love to truth that creates philosophy in the right environment. It's the final understanding, using the form, his conception of God or the form of the good, to hold all the other conceptions before it together and bring out the best in all of them. And of course, Christ later on bringing out the best in all of these and synthesizing the wisdom of the Old Testament and elsewhere, which is why the Greek inheritance was so important to the early church. The early church was almost completely Greek, which is no accident for this very same reason. We're not talking about the saccharine love, things like reproduction. That's not the issue, except only symbolically. We're talking about the fact that natural law says everything is held together by a force. That's what love is. It's the creation of harmony, however delicate it might be, the dim expression of logos in our day-to-day life. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.